Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
My name's Mick Coyle. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. I was off last week, but I'm back this week. Thanks to Dave Eason for sitting in the hot seat. The previous edition's all available to download as a podcast. We talk about mental health on the radio every Monday on Radio City Talk. That's exactly what we're going to be doing today. If you want to share your story or offer your thoughts, you can drop me an email, mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. We also do Mental Health Extra on a Tuesday as we discuss big talking points from the mental health world that are affecting things in the news. Got a great guest on the show today who's got a really interesting story to tell. I think it's going to chime with people who are listening to the programme as well, because it's the story of a partner and a mum and somebody who has lost somebody to suicide as well. We've got Lindsay Shorrock on the programme. Lindsay, thank you for your time. Great to see you.
And you, Mick. Thanks for having me.
Declarations, we know each other because we're from a similar town.
We do, yes, yes.
I've known you for a number of years. We worked together about 10, 15 years ago.
We did, which is just crazy. I can't believe it's that long ago. Yeah. It's a bit scary. It's been too long since we've seen each other, Mick.
And Lindsay, when she arrived in the studio, I said, oh, you've not changed a bit. But then she didn't repeat the compliment back to me.
I didn't return the favour. No, Mick, you've not changed a bit. Yeah.
I've gone really grey. Lindsay, it's a pleasure to see you. We're going to talk about a really difficult time in your life, though, that you've experienced as well. And we mentioned there's sort of different aspects to this story as well. And I think it's a story which is going to relate with different people, because they'll see it from different points of view. Should we talk about Calum? Tell us about Calum.
Absolutely. So, Calum. Wow. I met Calum at the start of 2007. He was my boyfriend. We fell in love very quickly. He was just an amazing guy. Sounds very cliche, doesn't it? I always feel that everybody in this situation always seems to say the same things. But honestly, I can't describe Calum any better than saying that he was the life and soul of the party. He lit up a room. He was just so full of fun and such a positive person. He was an amazing guy. And we fell in love. We were boyfriend and girlfriend. We lived together. We eventually had a little boy in 2012, Ollie. Such an amazing guy, but he suffered with mental health problems, and that first became apparent to me in 2009, sort of the September of 2009. Sadly, he couldn't fight any longer, and he took his own life in the July of 2016. So he suffered with mental health problems for sort of 6.5, nearly 7 years.
We were working together at the time, and you mentioned, you know, that first time when you get, I remember the conversations, yes, and these sort of little sort of ribbons and things like that, yes, that people do over new relationships and so on and so forth. Whenever you meet somebody like that and you have that period of, you know, falling in love, you obviously getting to know somebody at all. You say you became aware of the sort of issues maybe a couple of years into the relationship.
Yeah, it was. So it was the start of 2007. So I suppose we're talking 2.5 years later. Now we actually sort of hit a bump, I guess you might declare it, in our relationship. And we had a brief split, and it was at that time Calum sort of, you don't like using these phrases, but at the time, you know, he sort of lost it a bit. And he just took himself off, and nobody really knew where he'd gone. And this was at a time, like I say, we weren't together. And I remember his mum and dad contacting me saying, look, Lindsay, I'm really sorry to get in touch with you, but do you know where Calum is? Now, we were still in touch, and we were more than friendly enough, because obviously we did get back together. I was able to get in touch with him. He did respond to me, and basically he sort of said, oh, Lindsay, I've messed everything up, but, you know, I want to be with you. What's going on? I'm like, you know, Calum, I love you to bits. Come back, come home. We had some conversations that at that time we kept very private. And I suppose you look back and think, gosh, I should have maybe said something more, but he wanted me to keep these things private. And he told me you know, how he'd been feeling. And he actually had self-harmed in that time. So as much as I say we kept things private, I did actually encourage him. We sought professional help. So we did go to the doctors. And our family, our closest, you know, our parents were informed, but he didn't want to sort of tell our friends or any, you know, wider people. But yeah, so that was the start of it. And it was really shocking for me. I sort of thought, gosh, how I couldn't get my head around it. As you can't, if you've not suffered mental health problems yourself, you just can't understand how low and desperate people can feel. For me, I just eventually over the years just accepted that, you know, that was the case. But yeah, what I would say about Calum is that he was brave enough right at that initial point to talk about it and to actually reach out and get help or try to get help.
And that's the point. And, you know, the timeline's an interesting one because 2009, although it was 10 years ago, feels like yesterday for most people. And yet the world that existed there from a mental health awareness point of view was completely different to the world that's starting to kind of emerge now. I imagine, was that the era still of the pull yourself together, you Absolutely. Don't know how good you've got it, what have you got to be upset about? Was there still a sense of that?
Do you know what? Yeah, absolutely. And I can only assume that is why Calum didn't want to tell more people, because it was very much that. And as you say, the world's a different place now. But you could almost, when I think back over those sort of 6.5 years, you could see gradually that times were and are changing, because he got to a point where he felt more comfortable in, you know, telling our sort of close circle of friends. But I remember talking to some of my colleagues, because I was very close to them, who I worked for the police at the time. I didn't sort of give them every detail, but they were aware that Calum, you know, had some mental health problems. And I do actually remember one person saying to me, this actually isn't someone that I was particularly close with, so he didn't have the full story, but saying, oh, gosh, I can't believe, I mean, what's Calum got to be sad about? Look, he's got you, he's got Ollie, you've got a lovely home. And I just thought, wow, if only you knew, if only you realised. And that was only a few years ago in reality. So people had those views. So I can understand why it was so difficult for Calum to want to open up anymore.
During that time when you'd opened up, you managed to persuade him to speak to a GP. Did you spot things that were going on where you were going, I can see now that there's a mental health issue there?
To some extent, it's even at those times. And Calum himself, so he reached out and he had counselling. I mean, gosh, he had various levels of counselling over the years. And I guess this is the difficulty with mental health, because ultimately only when, I don't know if this was ever the right term, but we always referred to it as an episode, when Calum sort of went into his one of his real lows, it was only when he was in it that I'd be sat there thinking, God, I should have seen that. You know, the other day he did this, or the last week it was like this. But with the best will in the world, somehow, I don't know, you miss it. It's really, really difficult. And when Calum had counselling, he was sort of offered, you know, ways to manage and to spot the signs himself. And he would say it was, sometimes it was just too late. He was just in it. Before he knew it, he was in an episode, as like I say, as we would call it. Which just makes it really, really difficult. And I think the trouble as well was, he spoke out, but, and I don't always want to just sort of slate the system, but I do feel like he was failed, that, you know, the mental health support, it's just not good enough. It's not good enough, because he would reach out at a time that he needed it, but would then be on a waiting list for 6 months. And when 6 months came around, chances were he was actually in a relatively good place. So when that appointment came around, as much as I'd still say to him, you must go, Calum, no, I feel fine. So then he wouldn't have the appointment, but then maybe only a month or so later, he'd be back in it again, back to the GP, having to be referred in again. And it was like a vicious circle that he was caught up in, and could never quite get the right help at the right time.
Lindsay is sharing her story on this week's Mental Health Monday. Can I ask about your experience during those dark times? What was it like for you as a partner seeing your partner going through that?
In all honesty, it's one of the hardest things ever. I do not envy anybody going through a mental health problem personally, but also those people closest to them. You feel completely lost because you want to help this person so much, but with the best will in the world, other than offering your support and your love and your encouragement for them to try and seek help, which I suppose is what they need, but ultimately that doesn't solve the problem. You're sort of living on edge yourself. I remember there'd be times when I would, you know, I'd be at work and I'd ring Caleb's mobile. It'd go to voicemail and I knew that was him. He's off somewhere and we've got a problem. So you were constantly living on edge and in fear of what might happen. Yeah, it's scary. And then, like I say, we had a little boy. So trying to, I mean, you know, Ollie's seven now, but tiny at the time, but wanting to protect him from any, you know, sense of what might be going on. It's a really hard and lonely place, actually, being that close to someone with those kinds of problems, because nobody quite gets it. Just like somebody with a mental health problem, no, unless you've had problems like that yourself, you can't quite understand. And equally, unless you've sort of been in that support role, you can't quite understand just how difficult it is.
When you said he would take himself off, was that mentally he would take himself off or physically?
Literally, yeah, both. So he would physically disappear. And I say disappear because for us, for, you know, our story, there must have been 4, 5, maybe 6 times that I actually had to notify the police because I was concerned for his safety. And yeah, he would just disappear. It could be to the Lake District. It could be somewhere closer to home. But he would just turn his phone off, cut off any contact, and we would not hear from him for 24 hours, maybe longer. And yeah, in that time, you are literally fearing that the worst could happen. And everyone would always say, you know, that it will never happen. Caelan won't do that. It will never happen. And obviously, ultimately, it did happen. And actually, prior to the worst happening, it was 3 years prior, so it was 2013. Caelan actually did make an attempt at that time, and fortunately, he was found in time, and he was taken to hospital, but could so easily have lost his life then. So I knew how serious this was, you know, to make such a serious attempt. You know, there's an intention there, and there was an intention there. And Caelan said it to me. I remember like it was yesterday. I remember in the end, he spent about 4 or 5 days in hospital in 2013, and we drove away from the hospital. And he said to me, he said, "Lindsay, I will do this one day." He said, "Might be 2 years down the line, 3 years, maybe 5 years, but I will." And I didn't know how to respond to that. I just thought, "Caelan, please, no." And I always said to him, "No, we can do this. We'll do this together. We will fight this. You will get the help." But he got tired of fighting. He got tired of fighting. That's what he said. He said it was just a constant fight and he was exhausted. And he always described it to me as a cancer of the soul is the way he described it. And he just said he didn't have, I say he said because there was a note, and he just said he didn't have that fight left in him anymore. So, you know, it's... you take comfort, don't you, where you can. And clearly it was the most devastating thing. I wish that had never happened. And if I could change it, I would. But the only thing I can think to myself is that at least he's not fighting anymore. At least he's at peace, or I hope he's at peace.
It's so heartbreaking, Lindsay. It really genuinely is. Because I think from your point of view, anyone's just heard, you know, your story of events there, you've done everything you can. But actually, you know, to be driving away from the hospital, having had the problems, and then that's what you hear in the car, where if you break your leg, which is the comparison we always make, mm-hmm. the journey home is when you've been fixed
exactly.
and your recuperation exactly. begins at home. To hear that on the way mm-hmm. home, which should have been the start of yeah. a positive journey.
Absolutely.
Confirmed that this was a negative journey.
Absolutely. It was absolutely heartbreaking to, first and foremost, for somebody you love so much, to be going through that. I mean, like I keep saying, I can't even begin to understand what that must feel like. And I just got to a point of acceptance where this is real. Mental health is real, because the person I love most in the world, apart from my little boy, is telling me that he doesn't want to be here. So it's real, because he did have everything to live for. And yeah, it was heartbreaking. And this is where, like I say, I don't want to just sort of slate the system, but and obviously with any sort of health, mental, physical health, sometimes people will always lose their battle. With the best will in the world, whatever interventions you have, somebody will always lose their battle. But I just feel like people with mental health, it's just, it's a bigger battle than others. And, you know, we go back to 2013. So, you know, Caelan attempted to take his own life. He ended up in hospital. This was a Monday. Thank goodness he was sedated. And then when they and I was told, I remember saying, is he going to be all right? Will he survive? And they couldn't say yes to me. They said, we will attempt to wake him up in the morning and we will see. Now, thankfully, he was fine. So that was a Tuesday morning. Bear in mind what had happened, what he'd done. It was Friday before he was seen by a mental health professional. He was put on a ward with stroke patients. There were three old chaps around him who were lovely men. I remember it, you know, chattering away. But I thought, Caelan has been through, so Caelan has taken a course of action. He's woken up in hospital. Goodness knows what must have been going on in his mind, you know, having attempted to take his own life, and he wakes up and he's still with us. And then he's not seen by a mental health professional until the Friday. And like you say, you use the analogies of the broken arms or the broken legs. And I remember getting so angry at the doctor that I was speaking to. I said, to me, this is likening somebody coming in with a broken arm, and we're not going to even look at you until Friday. We'll stick you on a ward, but we might x-ray it on Friday and have a look at it then. It felt ludicrous to me that this guy had done this, and yet nobody with a mental health background was speaking to him and helping him to process his thoughts and his feelings. And it just astounded me.
Lindsay's sharing her story on Mental Health Monday for this week. If you are affected by any of the issues, don't forget you can find mental health services close to where you are by visiting her hubofhope.co.uk. You can actually just type in your postcode there or use the location device on your device, and that will find local mental health services to you. There's also links there through to the Samaritans as well as other organisations. hubofhope.co.uk. Lindsay, unbelievable version of events and unbelievable sort of poise with which you've shared those events. Is there a sense of frustration that in a world where we're talking about reaching out, share, talk, that even before the era we're in now, you were trying to do it, Caelan was trying to do it, you were in connection with the sort of medical world as well, and yet the right connection wasn't able to be made? That, you know, you did all the right things. You played the game, if you like, in regard to speaking to people at the right time. But just when it came to square pegs, it was always round holes. Was there a sense of that? Is that a frustrating thing, or does it get?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think frustration is the right word. Because like you say, now everybody, and rightly so, we encourage people to speak out, to talk about your feelings, to talk about your mental health. And Caelan was brave enough to do that. You know, he didn't necessarily shout about it from the rooftops and tell the world, but he told me his parents were aware, my parents were aware, and he sought medical help. He went to the professionals on numerous, numerous occasions. And I'm not saying that they didn't help. I think for Caleb, probably when he got his best help, if that's the right way to describe it, was when he was at his crisis points. He was able to make contact with what was called the crisis team. I think it has a different name now. And that was, as the name would suggest, you reach out to that team when you are at crisis point. So ultimately, that is a short-term intervention. So the crisis team would stay with him maybe for a number of weeks, 2-3 weeks. But then that would be where their intervention ended, and he'd be on a waiting list for perhaps cognitive behavioural therapy. But that would be 6 months down the line. So what did you do in that meantime? He was sort of trying to support himself, which he often did. And then he'd get better in his own mind. And when the appointment came around, he felt he wouldn't need it. But then eventually he would. And like I've said, it's a vicious circle. So whilst we encourage people to speak out, and that is absolutely the right thing to do, of course we need to continue. People need to have this conversation. For some people, because again, like physical health, such a broad spectrum, isn't it, mental health? So for some people, just speaking to your mates about, however you're feeling, there might be something going in your life, that might just be enough, actually. So that is why it's so important. And I would just channel that message. But for those people that need more and that actually need a medical intervention, it does worry me somewhat, because if we're encouraging more and more people to speak out and seek help, I genuinely believe that the mental health services can't cope at the minute. They can't cope with the levels of people that they're having to see right now. So if this message is going to get through to people, which I hope it does, then that's only going to increase the demand on services. And that is my worry. Is my worry, that they won't be able to cope even more.
I think that's always the thing about the stat about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people. That's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 people who may or may not have a mental health issue over the course of a year that we know about who might talk about it. And if they did talk about it, would they then find that was 2 in 4,
exactly,
3 in 4? And then suddenly then that the whole thing changes, doesn't it? So that there's got to be a response, because this is potentially an issue for many people for a significant and long period of time right along the line. Can I ask you about, obviously, all the while, you're a young family starting out. Now, anyone who's been in that place with a young family and the nappies and everything that comes with it as well, that's a really difficult time as well. In terms of memories, family memories, are you able to look back at family times with a positive slide? Were you able to get those moments?
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I should say and want to say, Caleb, he was the most amazing daddy. Honestly, I just don't think there is anybody out there that it came more naturally to. I feel when we had Ollie, I feel he taught me so much about being a parent. I mean, obviously, as the mum, you're always seen as the one, I was the one doing the breastfeeding, I was the one that, up in the night, but it just came so naturally to Caleb, and I just don't, not to put the dads down, far, far from it, but he was an absolute natural at being a dad, and he was the best dad in the world. And my goodness, it is. It's filled. I just look back. We had so many lovely times as a family. But the thing that breaks my heart the most, actually, and this is what Caleb would often say, he felt like he was letting Ollie down because of his issues. He just felt like and this is what he said, he felt like we would be better off without him. He used those terms, as I'm sure many people like Caleb have probably said to their family members, but he genuinely believed that Ollie would be better off without him. And I used to say to him, Caleb, Ollie, he looked at that, he was his hero, absolute hero, even from being tiny. But I think Caleb genuinely did believe that, because actually prior to Caleb's death, we were no longer in a relationship. He had actually taken the decision probably about 6 months before to leave. And that those were his words. He said, you and Ollie are better off without me. I'm bringing this family down. You will live a better life. Now, that was the last thing I ever wanted. And I just, all I ever wanted to do was to keep our little family unit together, that, you know, the two of them were my world. But obviously, because we did have our little boy, we stayed tremendously close. We were completely on good terms. And in those 6 months when we, you know, were separated, if you will, he still confided in me. And I know he had a number of times where he felt really down. And it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks before his death. I'd encouraged him to go to the doctors again because he was in a bad place. And he did go to the doctors. I remember him texting me a photograph of his medication. And he was like, "I've got my medication." He was like, "I'm on it. I'm going to beat this. I'm going to do this." And I was like, "Of course you are, Caelan." And I said, I'm there, you know, always, every step of the way. And then it was actually when myself and Ollie, we went away on a holiday with my parents. And that's when he took his own life. And I think in his head, he was tired, he was exhausted, but I think he believed that somehow everyone was better off without him. And that just makes me so, so sad, because he was just a great guy. He had so much to offer. You know, and you asked about the memories, we had great family times. And it just sounds almost ridiculous, because if the one thing that stays with me and how Caelan influenced me and my life, it was his positivity. He was so healthy because he was a personal trainer. So he was incredibly into his fitness, his health and well-being, really positive. And yet somebody so positive was just so, you know, affected by mental illness. And it's just not fair. It's just not fair. I mean, nobody deserves this, but he just didn't deserve this. And obviously Ollie, you know, he didn't deserve to lose his dad at 4 years old. It's heartbreaking.
And I guess as well, it throws up that issue of conversations that we can have with children about those things, not just that might have happened to a loved one or a father figure, but also how we talk to our kids in general.
Absolutely.
About bringing them up in a way where they can have those conversations from earlier on. I'm sure it's something you've considered.
Yeah, this is something I am very conscious of. And it's scary, actually. I feel like there's a huge weight on my shoulders because I'm so concerned with sometimes saying the right things and making sure he's going to be all right. I mean, we talk about Daddy all the time and Daddy understands that, Ollie understands that Daddy had a poorly mind. If there's one thing that I have to ensure, it's that Ollie will feel comfortable, you know, talking about his feelings, being open with me, you know, making sure that he, because even, you know, you still hear, don't you? You still hear. I see other people, you know, particularly with little boys. "Oh, don't be so soft. Don't cry. Don't be like a girl." And I'm so conscious of even those little comments. You know, if Ollie's crying, gosh, he can cry all day and night about something. And perhaps I'm too far the other way. I don't know. But I'm just, it's one thing that I am so determined to just make sure he is comfortable in opening up and chatting just about everyday life. So we make sure we have those conversations, you know, after school, just how's your day been? What have you been up to? And just knowing that, allowing him to, just to talk about his feelings, letting him know that, you know, we're always there for him.
Yeah, and that absolutely normalises it by saying, you know, a poorly mind, and the same way you have a poorly tummy.
Exactly.
And that is about, you know, young people understanding that difference or similarity between physical and mental health. Lindsay, we're out of time. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Many aspects of it, I think, will resonate with so many different people as well. And we thank you for being so honest and joining us on the programme. It's an absolute pleasure to see you again, Lindsay, and hopefully we'll catch up with you again very soon. Lindsay and her story on this week's Mental Health Monday from Radio City Talk. Don't forget, if you've been affected by any of the issues that have been discussed on the programme, hubofhope.co.uk has links to mental health services close to where you are. You can check that out via the website hubofhope.co.uk, and there are also text services available via Chasing the Stigma and also James's Place if you need to speak to them. It's Mental Health Monday from Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.